there's been a lot of international outrage at the drone specifically. We seem to be in the minority with accepting them. But is there anything that's more morally reprehensible about drones than on-the-ground combat?
There are people who would say that on-the-ground combat is a more in tune with the rules of warfare, where you see your enemy, where you're putting your own lives at risk. If you, as a nation, are so committed to this fight, then you should be willing to put your fighters in the fight. And what we're having now is our nation more willing to put at risk the non-combatants living in the areas where our enemies are and not put at risk the lives of our own combatants. And in the international rules of warfare and also the tenets of what's called the just war, these drone strikes are seen as barbaric, which is quite interesting because if you ask an American what's a barbaric kind of warfare, they would say somebody taking a machete maybe and chopping off someone's head. And that certainly seems barbaric to me. But to the victims on the ground, this kind of hellfire missile that's coming out of the sky from nowhere and just obliterates people in an instant with no chance to surrender, no chance of proving their innocence, is seen as barbaric from the victim's point of view.
And what countries are for the drones? I mean, we're not joined by that many people.
Well, there was an interesting poll that was taken by the polling group called Pew, and they polled 22 different nations, and they asked the question about the drone strikes, and it turned out that the United States and England were the only countries where the majority of people said it was cool to use the drones to kill people, and the rest of the countries in differing degrees said no. And when you looked at some countries like Egypt or Jordan, which is a U.S. ally, or Greece, a country in Europe, 9 out of 10 people in those countries said that they voiced their opposition to the drone strikes. So the majority of people in the world think that this is a pretty barbaric, unfair, unjust, inhumane way of waging war.
Why is it okay to not risk U.S. lives, but to kill civilians, it's okay in another country? What's going on with that othering?
I think it's an expediency on the part of our government that they recognize that when Americans are killed, you read about it in the newspapers. You know, at the beginning of the wars post 9/11, photographers were not allowed to even take pictures of the caskets of the bodies coming home. And the family members actually fought that because they wanted people to see that their sons and daughters were coming home in a box. And the U.S. government has tried to keep this war away from the American people. But when an American person dies, the local newspaper talks about it. There's mentions oftentimes in the press. And people don't like that. They don't like seeing our sons and daughters coming home in a box or coming home traumatized or with brain injuries or amputated legs. And so our government has recognized that it's easier to keep these wars going if American lives are not at risk. I would say it's unethical. I would say it's immoral. But it is expedient for our government if it wants to continue waging war and the American people, as they are tired of war.
What about these victims? Who are they? I mean, I know you've talked to a few people from Pakistan who have been survivors of drone attacks. Could you tell us some of those stories?
Yeah, but first to talk about who are these victims, I was recently at a meeting with the California director of Senator Dianne Feinstein's office. And we were going on and on about this issue, and he kept talking about the enemy, the enemy, the enemy. And I just said, you know, who is the enemy? And he just raised his hands up in the air, exasperated, and he says, damned if I know. We don't know who this enemy is, but it's this perpetual enemy that we have. And when this is a secretive program, as it is right now, and is killing people that are the enemy, but we don't have journalists there to tell us who these people really are, it's very hard to get these stories. And I was determined to get the story and went myself to Pakistan and Afghanistan right after 9/11 because I didn't believe my government when they said we have these high precision weapons and we only get the bad guys. And I didn't even have to get into Afghanistan to find out that that was a big lie because I saw the stream of refugees coming out of Afghanistan after the U.S. had launched all of these attacks. And I talk in the book about the first girl I met in the streets of Peshawar was a 13-year-old girl named Roya, and she was begging on the streets. And when I found out that she was from Kabul, I asked if I could get her story, and we got a translator, and we sat down. She took us back to the mud hut that she lived in. And it was just horrifying to hear her tale because she lived in Kabul on the outskirts of a Taliban compound. And her father was a laborer, a farmer, and her mother was at home one day with a couple of her sons and daughters when suddenly a drone attacked and a missile hit the wrong place and hit her house. And she had been out of the house with her father. When they came home, they found bits and pieces of the family on trees around what had been their home. The mother had been vaporized. Two of the sons and one daughter had been killed as well. And she described how her father went and carefully collected the little bits and pieces of body parts that he could find, buried them, gave them a ceremony, prayed, and then never spoke again. And I met this man, and I'll never forget this man because he was a beautiful, big, tall, 6 foot, strong guy with strong hands. You could just see the calluses from all the work in the fields. And there he sat on the edge of this bed made of straw and sat and looked into space. And this 13-year-old girl said, he doesn't speak. He hasn't worked a day since that happened. And after the family suffered that tragedy, this young girl, Roya, had to collect whatever goods they could find and take the father and the three remaining siblings and start walking through very treacherous territory and the Khyber Pass to get into Pakistan, where now they are trying to survive by begging in the streets of a very, very, very poor community. And that was the first time I had a chance to meet a victim of our drone attacks. And it has stayed with me ever since. 10 years later, it's still with me. And it will continue to be with me. And it's one of the things that keeps me going because Roy was the same age as my younger daughter. And I wonder what has happened to her, what's happened to her father, how is the family surviving. And I look at my own family, the kind of opportunities that my children have. And I think that, you know, how can we continue to live with ourselves when we are so concerned and will do everything in the world to protect our own children, but will allow our government to kill the families of other people without regard for who we've killed and what's happened to those survivors? Because remember, we're not only killing individuals, we're orphaning thousands of young children who then have little ways of surviving, few opportunities, and they're living in one of the poorest parts of the entire planet.
So we've kind of created this community of trauma in northern Pakistan. How do they view the U.S.? Is there any talk of reparations? What happens for this community in the future if this is their collective memory?
That's a good question. And I think we are destabilizing a nuclear country, which is Pakistan. We're destabilizing a very populated country. We're destabilizing a country that already has ethnic differences, and that we are unleashing perhaps some really terrible divisions like we did in the case of Iraq. And the traumatized people are now fleeing from the place they came for refuge in northern Pakistan. They're fleeing into the teeming cities like the city of Karachi and creating all kinds of new problems in those already overcrowded cities. So who knows what the ripple effects of these drone strikes will be, but they will not be pretty. And I think the U.S. government and the military have no conception, just like they did in Iraq, about how their limited view of taking out a dictator like Saddam Hussein or of trying to find some al-Qaeda members, but doing it in the indiscriminate way that they are doing it now, the kind of effects that it has on massive numbers of people and the potential for tremendous instability and the tremendous blowback that might come. How do people in that region view America? They hate America. They hate Americans. They would hate you and me if they met us because it would be very hard for them to distinguish between you and me and our government. And how can you blame them? That's all they know of the United States. All they've seen from us is the buzzing overhead of an ominous killing machine and the destruction of their communities.
What kind of resistance has formed on the ground in Pakistan? Is there anybody trying to fight the drones or document what's going on with survivors?
Well, you know, we haven't talked about the Taliban, and the Taliban, in many cases, are pretty treacherous and have killed a lot of innocent people as well. And so most of the people in that region are caught between a rock and a hard place. When we kill family members, they often join the Taliban, not because they believe in the Taliban ideology, but they're looking for revenge, and that's the only way that they can see to do that. But most of the people, as in people all over the world, are peace-loving people who want to see an end to the violence, whether it's the violence of the Taliban, the violence of al-Qaeda, or the violence of U.S. drones.
What about government attempts to go to the U.N. and talk about drone attacks or to stop drone attacks in Pakistan?
It wasn't until June of 2012 that this issue really came up at the United Nations. And the UN Commission on Human Rights had commissioned a report. And the report is very damning of the United States. And it calls on the United States to disclose under what rationale and what legal justification they have for these drone strikes. And is also pointing out that under international law, you must give your enemy a chance to surrender. And drones do not give the enemy a chance to surrender. And they are also asking the United States to give reparations to the drone victims. This is very important. This is the first time that the United Nations has brought up this issue of reparations. And I think it gives us an opening to work with people around the world to strengthen that voice, to be saying to the United States, you must account for the victims that you've killed. You must bear responsibility for them, and you must compensate their families. Now, we want them to stop, but part of the effort in a campaign to get the U.S. government to stop something like that is to first get them to acknowledge and accept responsibility and pay reparations.
What about community responses? Journalists are not allowed on the ground in this area. So what about documentation or community responses to victims and their trauma?
There has been an outpouring of response from the Pakistani people. And it's interesting because it cuts across political parties. There's tremendous division among political parties in Pakistan. But when this issue came to the legislature, they voted unanimously, probably something unheard of in the Pakistani legislature, unanimously to call on the United States to end the drone strikes. And then at the grassroots level, there have been rallies of hundreds of thousands of people who have come out. The best known athlete in Pakistan was a former rock star when it came to sports is Imran Khan. And he has his own political party, and he has made this issue of drone strikes a central issue and has led protests with hundreds of thousands of Pakistanis. There are also Pakistanis who have sat down in the road in front of the U.S. base to not allow the U.S. to continue to use the base there, which is a big issue now between the U.S. government and the Pakistani government. The majority, the vast majority of Pakistanis, no matter their political feelings and probably their opposition to the Taliban, they still are vehemently against the drone strikes. The legal community is also starting to come out in Pakistan to try to investigate these drone attacks. And we have recently made friends with a man who is he was a corporate lawyer. He worked with the U.S. Agency for International Development. He used to come back and forth to the United States with an expedited visa. And then he started looking into the drone attacks, left his practice, works for free for drone victims, and has become pretty much persona non grata in the United States because he sued the CIA in Pakistan for murder. In fact, he sued the chief of the CIA in Islamabad by name. They weren't able to get very far with the lawsuit, but they did manage to make sure that the chief had to flee the country. And they are trying to sue their own government for not stopping the U.S. They say, hey, if our government says that the U.S. has no right to be here and shouldn't be here, why isn't our military shooting down these U.S. drones? So they are looking and suing anywhere they can, even in the UK, where the laws are easier because the UK is giving information to the US and working together with them on the drone strikes. So it's very interesting to see how the legal community is finding different ways to use the court system to try to challenge these.
Is there any attempt to get documentation from within northern Pakistan through people who are living there? Because journalists can't go in, so we have very little information about the victims.
Yeah, I think it's in the interests of the Pakistani government, of the U.S. government, and the Taliban not to release information. So there is really a conspiracy among strange bedfellows to keep people uninformed about what's happening in that region. And that's why there was a meeting in 2011 that brought together hundreds of people from the region to the capital city of Islamabad, including about 80 family members of victims, to talk about this. And one of the things they came up with was that they had to train some of their own people with video cameras and still cameras to become the citizen journalists so that this information could get out into the international community. But there is a very tragic incident that happened just after this gathering, and that is about the young boy, a 16-year-old named Tariq Aziz. And he was very upset about the drones because his cousin had been killed by a drone, was very eager to be one of the citizen journalists. He did the training. He was given a video camera. And lo and behold, the first investigation that was done after this gathering was his own death, which happened 2 days later by a drone strike. This, unlike other drone victims, got out into the international press because lawyers from around the world had just been with this young boy, had just met him. They talked about having just shook his hand, touched his flesh, looked into his eyes, taught him things. And they were outraged that this young man had suddenly been killed. But it shows how the lack of information we have, the lack of humanization, and when it happened to somebody that had met people from the outside world, it caused a wave of outrage. And I think this just shows that we have to continue to find ways. And that's why we are taking a group to Pakistan the first week of October, the first ever U.S. peace delegation. We want to walk to the region. We want to get in there. We want to be together with the drone victims and their family members and the people who are terrified by hearing the buzzing of the drones overhead day in and day out. And so we're hoping that our government and the Pakistani government will allow us to do this, and we will be able to show the millions of people in Pakistan and people around the world that there are indeed Americans who care about them and who are determined to stop our government from killing them. There's something else just to say about Tariq Aziz, who was killed. And that is, first, the U.S. government said, oh, he wasn't 16. He was 18, 19, 20, as if that made it okay. And then they said, and he was connected to the Taliban. Well, the lawyers who were there said, wait a minute. He was 4 days in the capital city in a hotel known to everybody. If he were indeed a dangerous Taliban militant, you could have just walked in that hotel and arrested him. Why didn't you do that? And I think that's a very important question to ask. Why isn't the U.S. working with the Pakistani government to have people arrested? Why aren't they working with the government in Yemen to have people arrested? And it goes back to this issue we talked about earlier, how it's much easier to just kill people, get rid of the problem, than it is to arrest people and follow the international law of giving people a chance for a fair trial.